Welcome to the Interior Design Podcast. I'm Hayley Roy, a commercial interior designer with a passion for creating beautiful functional spaces. Over the years, I've worked on a variety of projects and I've accumulated a wealth of knowledge, which I'm excited to share with you. I started this podcast because I believe in the power of interior design. So much of what we need to know as designers, you won't learn in a classroom. Whether you're an aspiring designer, tackling your home project, or a seasoned pro, this podcast is for you. Season 2 is here, and I couldn't be more thrilled to kick things off with some fresh energy and exciting changes. This season, I'm joined by not one, but two incredible co-hosts, Hannah Denny and Scarlett Mallett. Together, we're diving deeper into the world of design to bring you more perspectives, lively debates, and all the tips and tricks you need to thrive. We're here to offer practical advice, discuss the latest trends, and give you unfiltered, real-world insights. Expect honest conversations, a bit of humour, and maybe even the occasional strong opinion and language. Remember, if it's not fun, we're not doing it. And if you're a sound editor looking for a fun collaboration, let us know. We'd love to have you on board. Thanks for tuning in to season 2 of the Interior Design Podcast.
Welcome to the Interior Design Podcast. Dawn Scott is with me on Teams. Dawn is a senior colour designer at Akzo Nobel / Dulux Trade. Dawn, did you want to introduce yourself?
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for having me on the podcast. I'm very happy to be here. So yeah, my role is senior colour designer at Dulux Trade. I have been an interior designer for a little over 20 years, and I now work as part of the commercial colour services team for the Dulux Trade brand. And my role essentially is creating kind of bespoke colour schemes for commercial buildings across all kind of sectors, and also working with architects and designers and kind of creative specifiers to support them with knowledge about colour and product, and, you know, advice on maximizing kind of color use in commercial spaces for the benefit of kind of all users. So I've got a particular passion about designing for neurodiversity and designing inclusive spaces. So that's kind of something that kind of is always at the forefront of kind of any information and kind of guidance that I like to share with people. So yeah, I've got a fab job because I get to work on lots of projects with lots of different people, and I love it.
Yeah, we met on Teams, didn't we, a few months ago after the Colour of the Year, sort of talking about doing this podcast, didn't we? And we both have kids who are neurodivergent, and we're both a bit kooky as well, so it's quite definitely nice to be able to have such a lovely conversation with somebody without having met them. It's great. Thank you so much.
No, I love it. Yeah, I think when I meet someone who says that their child or children are neurodivergent, immediately I go, yes.
Yeah, me too. You're in the club.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Someone that will understand me when I talk and go off at a tangent, or will not necessarily understand, but kind of not be concerned about that, you know, or kind of get it, totally get it. So yeah, I love it.
Yeah, me too. It's cool. So today we're talking about LRVs.
Yeah.
Well, we get distracted. Yeah. About neurodiversity. Yeah. So we're going to dive deep into light reflectance value, LRVs, and why it's crucial for creating functional, beautiful and accessible spaces. Whether you're choosing paint colours, designing for neurodivergent clients or planning lighting schemes, understanding LRV can make all the difference, and we're going to break it down today. Yes. So, Dawn, I am incredibly frustrated by LRVs because I want everything to contrast, and there's too many things to contrast, and it drives me nuts a lot of the time. So I'm really excited about having you on here to talk about this, because there's a few things that I kind of like. I've got some examples which I'll share with you later. Yeah. But to start with, can you explain what LRV means and how it's measured?
Yeah, so LRV is light reflectance values, and it's essentially the amount of light that is reflected back from a surface, and it's measured with a spectrophotometer. Spectrophotometer essentially is what that is. And basically that's used, this, you know, a spectro is used to like I say, analyze the amount of light reflected back from a surface. So the color of a surface will affect how much light is reflected back, as will the finish. So we'll come on to finishes later, but for now, let's kind of stick with that. So so from a paint, actually, I'll talk about finishes just briefly. So from a paint perspective, an eggshell finish or a matte finish or something like a satin wood, the color will be truer than something that has a gloss finish. So something that has a gloss finish, the color appears darker. So the light reflectance, or the LRV, is measured. So we at AXO, we have two measurements. We have a non-gloss and a gloss kind of one. So we tend to work with the non-gloss figures when we're kind of putting schemes together. But essentially, that unit of measurement is used for ensuring there are sufficient difference in contrast from adjoining critical surfaces in a space. So adjoining critical surfaces, those critical surfaces are things like the ceiling, the walls, the floors, the doors. So the guidelines, British Code of Practice, BS 8300, is that there should be a minimum difference of 30%, so that's 30 points of light reflectance value between certain critical surfaces. So the in those guidelines, they say that the ceiling needs to be sufficiently different from the walls, so it needs to be 30 points of difference. And then what they say in it is that then the architrave and the door as a whole also needs to be 30 points of difference between the wall and then the wall.
Ceiling and walls.
Yeah, ceiling and wall need to be different. So the architrave and the door as a whole need to be 30 points of difference between the wall and the floor. And obviously then the wall.
Sorry, Diane. Should the architrave be the same colour as the door?
So the guidelines say that, yes, it can be. However, what I always do from a professional perspective is try to make the architrave contrast with the door as well. Because for me, the door is the moving part. So the architrave, I absolutely think that, yes, the architrave needs to, you need to identify that as the end of a wall, essentially, with an opening of some kind. But for me, it's the door that moves. So the door needs to have the contrast. So when I do colour schemes, I will always try and get that extra level of contrast. However, if you were just doing it to code, you were just doing it to the regulations, the architrave and the door can be the same colour.
So then you've got four things, though. This is my problem.
Well, yeah, but hold on a minute. So then the other thing to just add to that is the skirting. So the skirting, again, the guidelines say that the skirting can be the same colour as the wall, because what the important thing is that junction between the floor and the bottom of the wall, because this is about, primarily about somebody that will have a visual impairment and they need to know where one surface starts and the other one finishes. So the guidelines say that, again, I will always try and make sure the skirting board contrasts as well. But you're absolutely right. There's all those different surfaces.
If they've got to be 30 points different and there's only 100, you've only
So what you can do is, so I always start with the ceiling. Because so the ceiling is absolutely a critical surface as well. But from a navigation point of view, I would say that's where you can have a little bit of flex, because usually a person with a visual impairment will kind of look up and look at the ceiling because that's the most uncluttered surface in a space, so you kind of get to see the size of the space. So I will always start with the ceiling. So let's say we painted the ceiling pure brilliant white. Okay, so that's got a light reflectance value of 93. So that means that the walls then need to have a light reflectance value of 63 or lower. So we can go lower, you know, but we shouldn't go any higher than 63. So just on that point, the guidelines do say that you can reduce it to 20 points under certain lighting conditions. Again, we don't at Dulux, we don't advocate for that. We say you should really always go for a minimum of 30, but there is that little bit of flex there. And you know, you need to read the guidelines to get the specifics about the lighting, but there is a bit of flex there. But let's for the purpose of this, we'll stick with 30. So our walls need to be 63. So let's say we find a paint color that has an LRV of 63. This is when I should have a Dulux paint name on the top of my head that is an LRV of 63. Hold on, what I'll do, I know, I'll find a colour for you. One second. I'll go in and I'll search for LRV 63 and let's see what comes up.
Can you actually do that on the Dulux website?
Yep.
Dulux.co.uk?
No, Dulux Trade Paint Expert. It's the...
Gentle Lavender.
Yeah, there we go. Yeah, so Gentle Lavender has got an LRV of 63. Yeah, so it works. You put the search in, put the LRV in, and it won't bring everyone up, but it'll bring some colours of LRV 63. So you've got 93 on the ceiling because we've got pure brilliant white. We've got Gentle Lavender, LRV 63 on the walls. Okay, so then the next thing we're looking at, and let's go with guidelines for now. So the architrave and the door then now needs to be 30 points different between Gentle Lavender, which is LRV 63. So we can go up 30 points. So we could go to LRV 93. So you could have the door and the architrave white because that's your 30 points. Or you could go down 30 points. So we could go to a colour that's got an LRV of 33. So if you wanted, you could, in theory, just use what, two colours? For argument's sake, you could do your wall, your architrave and your door white, LRV 93. And then if you also did the skirting board white as well, which is LRV 93, that's giving you the break at the bottom of the wall, you could then have the flooring the same colour as Gentle Lavender, LRV 63. Because between each surface, yeah, because you've got the break. I'm not saying that you would, but for argument's sake of an LRV, as long as you've got the break between the bottom of the wall and the floor.
So as long as your skirting is the 30 point different, that's a line across. So that defines that critical surface.
Yeah, yeah. If it doesn't, let's say we had the wall the same colour as the skirting board, then we've got that's an LRV of 63. So again, for the floor, we can either go up 30 points or down 30 points. So again, we could go to 33, which you would probably do with the floor, and you wouldn't go to, you wouldn't really want a white surface for a flooring practically, but you could go, you'd go down then to 33. So you find a flooring that's got an LRV of 33 and you've got your differences. So I think there is sometimes, we think that we've got to have all of these different colours. And as you said, if there's only 100 points, how are we going to do that? If we've got 5 or 6 different surfaces, the maths alone don't add up to that, do they? So how are we going to do that? But it's about looking at each surface one at a time and going, right, what is next to that? Where do we have to go? And like I said to you, with the wall, if the LRV is 63, then well, the next surface you're looking at, you can either go up or down. It doesn't have to be, you don't have to try and fit that into one space.
So if you had a white wall and you wanted a white ceiling, you would have a line. Or like a coving, for example, or you could just paint a line.
Yeah, yeah. As long as you differentiate where that is with something that has 30 points of difference. So yeah, it could be a line, it could be coving, it could be, you know, whatever. So yeah, so that's the guidelines. And again, if we were going to go over the guidelines, so if we were going to do the architrave, so let's take that example. So we've got ceiling of 93, we've got the wall is 63. So then let's do the architrave white again. So that's 93. So then the door needs to be 63 or lower. So again, we could have the door the same color as the wall if we wanted to, because the differentiation is there with the architrave. So again, it's about that kind of take each surface one at a time and go, right, what is the next one? Where do we need to go, higher or lower than that? I think there was a game in the 80s that was that, higher than 63, lower than 63. So yeah, so I think that's where you get the flexibility. So I think some people don't always think about that, because like you say, they think, oh, it's all
going
to be different.
I've been doing that for years, and I've been going, okay, well, I'm going to try and do these three critical surfaces, because I remember, I think it might have been you, I did a course about LRV a few years ago, and it was kind of three, I wrote it down in my diary, there's three critical surfaces that are the most important, and you can have your architrave the same colour as the door.
Yeah.
But actually, I've got a massive issue with that. Same reason as you have, because the architrave isn't moving and the door is. So actually, that's not great. If I was a visually impaired person, I wouldn't be appreciating that very much. So you've totally answered my question there. That's brilliant. Like, you just made my life a hell of a lot easier there.
Yeah, like I say, I think it's that. It's just like higher or lower. And then like you say, if you want to go over the regulations, and exactly that, as the door. I mean, the other thing to say about doors and architraves is, if it's in a space where you don't want the general public to have access to, so, you know, like plant rooms or things like that, then you can paint it the same color as the wall so that it kind of visually disappears. You can do that. It doesn't say you can't do that every door. It's about what we're thinking about is making life easier for people that have a visual impairment to move around public spaces. So of course, this doesn't apply to kind of residential spaces. However, if you were redesigning or redecorating your grandmother's house and she has dementia, then yeah, absolutely be thinking about this stuff. But if not, again, there's no regulations or guidelines that say you have to do that. But commercial interiors, that's what you think about. Where do people, the general public, need to navigate, and how can we make that easier? So like I say, plant doors and service room doors and things like that, you can paint that same color as the wall. It doesn't have to have that contrast. So yeah, the other thing to say is, then obviously that's just kind of the main critical surfaces, but you then need to think about things like handrails and, you know, signage and things like that. They all have to have contrast as well. Steps, everything everything needs to have furniture. You know, if you're designing a care home, then your surfaces all need to be different, but then you need to think about the furniture. So let's say a chair, armchair in a care home, you know, the armchair, if it's got legs on it, you need to make sure that they contrast from the carpet, so that, especially depending on what shape they are, to make sure it's not a trip hazard. But things like making sure the seats and the arms kind of contrast again against the flooring, so that somebody can see them easily to sit down. So think about preventing kind of trips and falls and all that sort of stuff as well. So that's when you kind of add to it. But I think again, it's the, are we going higher or lower than the next surface, the surface that we're already looked at, you know?
I think with furniture I really struggle as well, because sometimes you look that way and it will contrast perfectly, but if you look that way it doesn't. It's a minefield. I think what you have to do though, and I think I've heard you say this before, is you just have to be mindful.
Yeah.
And there's, you know, as long as you've got those critical surfaces and you've got all of that, because there's only 100 points, you can't possibly contrast it that much.
Yeah.
But like being mindful about it is going to, and I love that line, because you could put things like piping on furniture that would give it an outline.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm. So again, I think it's, like you say, being mindful of it, thinking, what am I trying to achieve here? I'm trying to achieve a level of contrast that somebody can see this. easily to be able to use the space. That's what it's all about, isn't it? We want people to be able to use the spaces intuitively. But it's not just people that are visually impaired. You know, there's some evidence to suggest that even if somebody has a hearing impairment and is signing, that the color contrast supports that as well. For me, though, it's for everyone. Like, we rely heavily on color and color cues so much, a lot of us don't always acknowledge that or appreciate that. So I think from a designer's perspective, it's about thinking about all of those things, like how can we make spaces more easier for people to use.
How would color affect somebody signing? How's that?
I think it's just the automatic recognition that if you're using one of your other senses, basically you're making the sense of sight not have to work so hard so that they can concentrate on their other senses. So if you can visually in your peripheral vision kind of see contrast of things, it means you don't have to stop what you're doing. So, you know, if you're signing, you need to be kind of looking at someone, either signing or lip reading, you need to be facing. So if you're out of your peripheral vision, you can clearly see the contrast of something as you're walking, then that's going to help you.
Yeah, I love that. I love that. Because, I mean, I've got ADHD. So, and I haven't actually, I don't think I've said this on the podcast yet.
Oh.
but I actually really like using disabled toilets because I like having that kind of everything in one place. But also, I when something is really visually clear, my brain's not working overdrive all the time. Yeah. So one of my traits someone with ADHD is I overthink everything. So medication definitely helps, but I do kind of, I'm constantly, my brain is constantly whirring. So when I can navigate without having to think, that really helps yeah. me. It's yeah. really odd, isn't it? I can't really explain it.
Yeah, no, I totally get that because
really resonated then. Sorry,
yeah.
I'm talking.
No, no, I think, I was just going to say exactly I feel exactly the same. So this kind of leads us actually nicely onto designing and using kind of colour for neurodiversity. So the guidelines, building regs and British Code of Practice have been based around people with a visual impairment. However, as you exactly as you just said, it helps other people as well. So if any of our other senses don't, you know, can be kind of our sight sense can be not have to work so hard, then again, it means that we can concentrate on other things and it helps everybody. I think even if you don't have a visual impairment, then, you know, the sensory side of things, the kind of neurodiversity, as you've said, you know, having a daughter who is diagnosed autistic and I am undoubtedly neurodivergent. For me, I want to quickly like see where I'm going and what I'm doing. So one of my biggest things that I have a pet hate about is toilet cubicles as well, but around the indicator of whether it's engaged or not, whether somebody's in it or not. And there have been a few places I've seen where they've kind of changed the little, you know, like the either a disc or whatever it is that you, when you lock from the inside, it changes the outside indicator. It used to be red and green. And I know there are a whole load of other kind of concerns about that for somebody that has color vision deficiency or, you know, color blindness, as it's commonly referred to. I totally understand that. But what some have started to do is it's a white disc. Now, I don't know. So one of the things for some people that are neurodivergent is they don't have or they don't necessarily register the cues of bodily functions. So one is you don't always know that you need the toilet until you're absolutely desperate to the toilet. So at the point that you're running to a public toilet, any delay in having to assess whether the cubicle is open or not. And yes, of course you can kind of do the pull in the door, but for me that's extra time. So for me it's like color is such a simple thing of notifying you whether a cubicle is open or not. And a white disc for me takes too long to process, even if it's, you know, milliseconds to go, it's white. What does that mean? Is it open? Is it closed? And that delay is like unnecessary for me. Unnecessarily, like, let's go back to some kind of color or a color and a symbol as well. You know, let's not get detracted by going down the symbol route. But for me, color has always been a thing. Same with taps. Every place I go to in a public environment that has a tap, I want to know which is hot and which is cold. And the way we do that is traditionally blue and red. And if that's not there, you're like,
wow. Hotel rooms are the worst, aren't they? When you're going into a shower, you're like, which way hot? Where's the colour?
exactly. So I think colour is a cue. It's a primary cue that we take, and it's subconscious a lot of the time. So don't take that away. You know, like, let's kind of make sure that we're getting that. So for me, an environment, the built environment for commercial spaces is exactly that. Like, we're designing for people with visual impairments, but what about all of the other people that maybe have sensory differences, or, you know, you don't want to be overloaded, or, like you say, are neurodivergent, and our brain has so many other sensory things to deal with in those spaces. Let's make what we can easier, take the pressure off a little bit. So yeah, absolutely, for me, key, and one of the things I'm absolutely passionate about. Yeah, I often will post things about space.
We need to do a podcast on neurodivergent interior
definitely.
Design, because I think that would be huge. I would love that. And we've got the HRC coming up. We've just designed a stage all around neurodiversity. It's March the 17th to the 19th. The HRC show. And we're going to do it on the stage. See the stage. It's going to look amazing. I'll put this on the podcast as well. You see that?
Oh yes. Wow.
So the idea, we originally designed this stage for the, not quite the same, but slightly different, but the idea of neurodiverse interior design for the independent hotel show. And we went in for a competition basically to design the stage, and we went up against a few other designers and we didn't win it. And the person who won did a treehouse, which was amazing. And I was like, yeah, wow. Okay.
Yeah.
but yeah, so we've used the same idea for the HRC, because we do the HRC every year that work with them in partnership. And we've used this as neurodiverse interior design theory.
Nice.
It's just very calm.
Yeah.
The idea is it's calm. And I'm just looking at the critical surfaces on here now and going, well, I don't know if I've checked that. I'm pretty sure we have. But I'm going to double check it before we go. Because that's not going to be good, is it? I think we have. But but just kind of making it and sort of the chairs that we're using are quite funky and cool, so they're a bit ADHD, but mainly it's supposed to be a calm space
for
everyone to breathe. It's going to be good. We're not quite finished this. This gold is going to change colour, because we're not quite happy with that, but I am going to check the critical surfaces and make sure they're very 30 points.
More so, do you know what though? I think it's that from that it's the where the stage stops, and so, you know, when we talk about critical surfaces, it's that, isn't it? It's those things. It's like, where are people going to be navigating, you know, around it, and is that kind of, is it going to be, can they see the difference basically between those things? But then also, you know, is this, the stage is not necessarily for the general public either, although it's a public space. So you need to make sure the end one, so that it's not a trip hazard. But anything else. But it looks lovely.
But if we were to do the podcast, we would sit here. And just chat. Me and Cheryl did it last year. It was really good.
Nice.
But yeah.
Yeah, it's lovely.
So if you're up for that.
I'll have a look at
the end day, but I haven't been given a date yet, so it'll be 17th, 18th or 19th at the moment. So
is your like office or wherever you are, is it near to your home? Is it like right next to you? Is it in the grounds of like where your house
not
is?
At my house.
No.
So I my son goes to school in a little village called Alford, which is where the studio is. We used to be in Elmstead Market, which is right near my house.
Right.
which is about 5 minutes down the road anyway.
Yeah.
But my dad has got a site in Alsford, where he's got lots of warehouses, and we used to have a warehouse here before, but we never had an office.
Yeah.
And somebody built an office in the warehouse, in a warehouse on his site, and they moved.
Yeah. Oh.
He phoned me and he's like, I've got a warehouse with an office in it. I'm like, ah.
Yeah, perfect. Oh, that's
so, yeah, so we're here, but we've only been here a little while, and hence why we're decorating the office, because the people who were in here before, I decorated the office, it's like this muddy grey colour. It's like this colour here. Mm. And it's all right. It's like the most decorated place in the whole warehouse. So it's kind of been shelved for 6 months because it's not really necessary, but actually it's driving me nuts. Like the colour is like making me feel really gloomy. So I'm literally just spending every half an hour that I've got spare, I'm just like going, I'll just do that bit.
Yeah, just doing so a bit. So
you can probably see, like, I've got like half done that wall there. I've like gone over the edge.
Going the edges.
But okay. For me, I'm so sensitive to colour.
Yeah, me too.
And I thought it was the lighting to start with. Mm-hmm. And I started painting it because I was like, oh, I need to change the lights, need to change the colour. So I started painting the colour and I'm like, actually, it's not that bad in here now because the colour's
changed.
So I'm going white and I'm going to try and figure out what to do after that. But I think the walls will probably stay white with a splash of colour. Yeah.
Are you sensitive to light as well? I am. I'm very sensitive to kind of light and, like you say, colour. So my wall, you kind of can't see it here. I don't know if it will let me take off the background so you can see my wall. Adjust background. Let's see if it will let me. I'll take it off 2 seconds and then we'll record. Can you see that colour?
Oh, that's lovely.
So I've put that on because my this room is north facing. I've got incredible views out there, but because it's north facing, it is quite grey. And so I needed a colour that when I come in here, I need to be awake, to be working and not kind of, you know. So yeah, it's called Caribbean Dawn One. Honestly, it's so bright. But the sun has faded it a bit. I need to give it another coat because the sun, although the sun doesn't come around here till later, it's quite strong because we're quite, I'm quite high up and I don't have anything in front of me at my level. Everything's lower down because we're like at the top of the hill. So, so it's like super bright. But the rest of my house is quite calm. But this is really bright to kind of like wake me up because otherwise I'm just like. So, yeah, I'm sensitive.
We've been having sort of debates as to what colour to do the office. And the only one we agree on is white. So we've gone China white, Dulux Heritage China white. And we were looking at a sort of more yellowy white, but it's still too gloomy.
Yes.
And we haven't got any natural light in here.
Right.
So because we're inside an office, inside a warehouse, we have got two windows that go into the library. The library, in effect, is in the warehouse.
Yeah.
So I'm going to end up incorporating that into the office. We're going to insulate that all up and make it so it's fine.
Nice.
But then there's two skylights out there. The library is huge in here, which is lovely because our old library was tiny and we would have to be really sort of stringent about what samples we took in and what we didn't. And we have to clear it out all the time because we didn't have the space. But now we're kind of like, oh man, my library is like my heaven. Amazing.
Oh, heaven.
We've got little boxes with colour written on us. So we've got a box of blue. So everything that we love that goes on a mood board that we can reuse, we would put into those boxes. So we don't reuse a lot, but like all the neutral things, like all the staple things, we wouldn't use something loud more than once or twice. On different projects, but so anything staples, you know, brown leather and things like that, we keep just in the boxes and reuse it. So we want to recycle stuff and we don't want to chuck things away unless they're out of date, you know. We want to be able to keep the library and
What do suppliers do now about taking books back when they do they re-
we take them to schools.
Oh dear.
I've had three now. I've got a box out there actually waiting to go, but we've had three suppliers recently come in and go, they're out of date. And I've said to them, can you take them back and recycle them? And they said, no, you know, you can recycle them, but we don't use them again. What we do is we take them to the school.
That's good.
My son's school, or Scarlett's school that she takes her to. And and then they use them for crafting and things. So
yeah, no, that's good. It's getting used then, isn't it? Yeah, because otherwise I've got a load in my other room that I use, because I don't get involved with fabrics much these days, but I had a project last year where I needed to see some, so the suppliers sent me a box of like binders and stuff, and I'm kind of like, I'm gonna message them and go, look, I need you to take these back, because I don't have, like, I'm in this little office is my workspace, and I've got them piled up in my bedroom. I'm like, I don't want them in there, they're gonna have to go.
But I'll take them.
Well, yeah, there I live
this hoarder and, in the corner.
Yeah, I live and Panaz.
Oh, I've got them already.
Like I say, we obviously we don't use fabrics at work, so I can't, like, there's no use for them, there's no point me keeping them, I don't have space for them either. So yeah, I'm gonna talk to them about that, but that's an option. If they don't want them back, I'll be like, right, I'll take them to my niece's school, then they can they can use them. So yeah, cool.
For me, like, we are such consumers in the world of where we want to be sustainable as interior designers, and I'm just like, I'm trying to do everything to repurpose things all the time, and just if I can help not send things to landfill, I will.
Absolutely.
So many people throw things away that are worth something. They just go, oh yeah, chuck it in the bin, I haven't got time to recycle it. And it's like, just send it to the warehouse, I'll sort it out.
No, that's good, that's definitely good. It's very good.
So we've talked about what LRV means and how it's measured, how to use LRV in colour selections for walls, ceilings and furniture, tips for designing space with high contrast or subtle tonal changes. What does that mean?
Let's think. So something that I would say about colour. So we've talked about the LRVs and how important that is, but then there is another aspect to colour, which is the chroma. So other manufacturers have this, but from a Dulux perspective, our trade colours in the Fandek, the big Fandek 2200 colours, the notation is made up of three parts, and it's the same way that we see colour. So the first part is around the hue, so that's the colour family, so that's whether it's red, orange, yellow, green or blue. So for example, on a Dulux colour, the first bit might be 30 BB, so that BB means blue, and there are others, so there's GY, green, yellow, GG, green, which means it's true green. So that's the first part. And then the second part of the colour notation is the LRV. So we've talked about that. That'll be, and that goes from 0 to 99. But the highest, the brightest kind of colour we have is pure brilliant white that has an LRV of 93. And then kind of probably our lowest colours probably have an LRV of around 5, which is one of the blacks, undoubtedly. So that's the second part of it. And then the third part of the colour notation is the chroma. So that's how intense the colour is. So how much kind of blackness it might have in it. So that is, that goes from 0 to 999. So the higher the number, the more chromatic the colour, the brighter the colour. So not all hues, not all colour families will go up to that higher end. So yellows will obviously probably have a higher number than like the majority of the blues would go to, for example. But that's another aspect to consider when you're looking at colour and colour choice, because if you're kind of restricted by the LRVs and you're kind of, so for example, some projects for education, the Department for Education has guidelines that light reflectance values of walls need to be around 50. So let's just take that as a scenario. So let's say we're restricted the LRV of the walls have to be 50. So obviously there'll be a whole plethora of colours that have an LRV of 50. But then what you can do is you can look at that last part of the colour notation to see how chromatic a colour is. So you can still achieve contrast and kind of tonal variations by playing around with that end part of the colour, but still keep a light reflectance value of 50. So it's kind of like a hack, a cheat code, you know, like if you're being told you can only have an LRV of 50, well, that's great. You know, not all colours that have the same LRV are the same. You know, some will be brighter and some will be more muted than others. So I think that's the opportunity to then still create kind of subtle changes or the kind of change to the mood of a space by utilizing the chroma and looking at that. So if you go for a chroma that's kind of lower, so I don't know, 100 or a couple of hundred or something, then that's obviously going to be more muted, so that's going to have more gray in it and be less kind of pure than a higher number. So I think that's where you can use color and especially the Dulux Trade fan deck to tweak the changes in mood and appearance and feeling, and then still get those subtle tonal changes if you need it without having to revert to using different LRVs if you're restricted with that.
So if you were to use, so the chroma, if it goes to naught from naught to 999 and 999 is brighter, would not be something like a, would not be a black?
No. So let me get my fan deck out and I'll see if I can get you an example of what I'm talking about. I don't know if it'll show up on here. So let's go to yellows for a start. So similar, are they similar? Yeah, okay, let's see if we can use these two. I don't know if you'll see this. Let's try and see. Hold on.
I'll describe it as well for our listeners.
Yeah. So if anybody has a Dulux Trade fan deck, I'm looking at page 91 and 92. And what I'm going to show is the top two colours. So I'll read it first and then I'll show you, Hayley. So the top one has, and they're not exactly the same LRV, but has an LRV of 89, and the page behind has an LRV of 83. So not dissimilar, but the first one has a chroma of 88, and the second one has a chroma of 223. So I don't know, can you see how much brighter that is? So I know in this example the LRV isn't exactly the same, but you can see how much brighter, even on a pale color, how much brighter that is.
You're showing a on the fan deck, you're showing like a taupe beige color,
yeah,
on the left, but it's, yeah, the lightest version of that,
yeah,
and then on the right it's a yellow. So yeah, yellow would be higher in chroma, yeah, than beige,
yeah. But this is still, this one that's kind of there, that's still in the yellow category. Okay, so that's got, that comes from yellow. It's got a yellow undertone. But because the chroma is less, it's got less, it's had grey added to it. So that's why it's changed it from an obvious yellow to a kind of, like, say, more kind of taupey sort of colour.
So if you've got grey in it, if you've got more black, the more black in it, the lower the chroma.
Yeah. So at the very front of a fan deck, I mean, mine is a bit battered because obviously it's well used. It tells you this on the front page there. I'm kind of trying to put it so you can see. We have the colour wheel, and then we have the bit that tells you about light reflectance values. And then there's a little bar chart there that tells you about chroma as well. So that...
He just disappeared.
Yeah. If I hold still, we might see it there.
Yeah,
so it tells you there. So that kind of explains.
I've never even noticed that. I'm going to have a look in a minute.
Well, the other handy thing that's in there that you might have noticed is the surface finish, the gloss level indicator. So this is like the third page in your fan deck, and what this does is it tells you what different finishes look like. So there'll be matte on there, satin wood, eggshell, and gloss, so that they've all been painted the same color, but you can see how the surface finish changes the appearance of color. So that's a handy little tool in there in the front of the fan deck as well.
Thanks.
So yeah, so that's kind of, I'm just reading back what your question was about high contrast. Yeah, designing spaces with high contrast or subtle tonal changes. I think if you are aware of how the colour is made up, that can help you create those kind of things. Obviously, if you're designing spaces for people that are neurodivergent, then the guidelines around that is to avoid high contrasting spaces or anything that is too jarring or has too much contrast. And it's about making things more subtle and kind of easier and more comfortable. That's not to say, and I always like to add a bit of a, not a disclaimer, but a caveat to it, that if you're designing spaces for people that are neurodivergent, if you are able to talk to the end users about the space and what they want from it, then you should always do it. Because when we talk broadly about designing spaces for people that are neurodivergent or neurodegenerative, of course there's always an exception to the rule. You know, there will be, so the guidelines is avoid things like high contrast in high chroma colors like reds, oranges and yellows. But as I've just demonstrated, there are different chromatic versions of yellow. So, and of course the same with red and orange. But there will be some people who are neurodivergent who really love red or really love those kind of bright, bold, you know, kind of spaces. So I think we should, if it's a space where you can't talk to the user, you know, it's a general public space, then let's design spaces for so that the majority of people can feel comfortable in those spaces, which is different to designing for the majority. From a neurological profile, there is neurotypical, which is the majority. And then we have neurodegenerative, which are people that have like dementia or Parkinson's. And then obviously neurodivergent, which is ADHD, autism, Tourette's, dyslexia, etc. So we're not designing for the majority, but we're designing to make the majority of that combined neurodiverse population comfortable. So, you know, that's when we should think about contrast carefully and think about tonal changes and things like that. But if you can, it's always good to consult with the users. And also, if you can, offer the flexibility of spaces. So, like I say, some people are drawn to more brighter colours, but others are drawn to more subtle colours. A perfect example, actually, is my office, isn't it? Like I just said to you, my whole house is more muted colours. So I prefer muted, natural, kind of earthy kind of tones. But that wouldn't work for me in my office, which is why I've got this amazingly bright kind of Caribbean dawn wall, because I need that as well. But naturally, you know, I wouldn't navigate or levitate to that kind of space unless it wasn't for a specific reason. So yeah,
we had a podcast, one of the first podcasts that we did was with Karen Holler.
Yeah,
I'm assuming you know her. She's yeah. Marianne yeah. knew her, and she's got the book, the little book of color, and her yeah. favorite color is really similar to your wall.
Yeah,
and in the front of the book is the orange.
Yeah,
which is her favorite color. Yeah. So it's a bit more red than what's on your wall, but
yeah,
it's quite funny that you're both into color and you're both kind of drawn to that orange.
Yeah, I think it's personality as well. I think people have kind of like personality colors. So if somebody asked me what's my favorite color, it would be like a coral color. And when I was a bit younger, it was orange, like a brighter orange, and it's changed slightly a bit to more of a coral thing. But I will wear some items of coral clothing in summer, but in my house, apart from here, I don't have it anywhere. So ironically, you know, it's my favorite color. But I think when I think about it being my favorite color, it's because it gives me energy. And so I think about a favorite color for me, it's like, what do I want to kind of give me energy? But I couldn't have it anywhere else in the house. I need my house to be kind of calm, like you. My brain is always going like
He's having a little party.
Yeah, it's like constantly going. So I'm kind of like, I need the rest of my space to be like calm so that I don't have that, like, don't need to add fuel to the fire of my brain that's already going. So, yeah.
Do you know where LRVs came from? Did it start off with a slant on visual impairment?
Yeah, I think so. I think, gosh, it was probably way back. So there was something called Project Rainbow, which was, I feel like it was the early late 80s, early 90s. And prior to that, kind of things like the guidelines in building regs and what have you, would have been about like high contrast, so you know, red, white, black and yellow, you know, sort of thing. It was all about that. But Project Rainbow was a combination of basically like a focus group of different organizations. Dulux was one of the companies that participated in that. So was the RNIB, and I think maybe like Transport for London and a few others. So basically what they did is they looked at it more, and as part of that, it kind of, that's how we ended up with the current guidance around light reflectance values. So I don't know if light reflectance values were used in the industry before then. I suspect they were probably used for something else, maybe automotive or, you know, the like airplane industry or something like that, maybe. You know, I'm trying to think, I don't know what they would be useful for, but I'm sure they were used for other things. But I think that was perhaps the time when colour on and surface finishes was looked at in more detail, and with kind of the experiments that were done as part of that project, it was realised that actually we could have more flexibility and design aesthetically pleasing spaces while still meeting in the contrast. So I think it was probably then. I mean, I don't know if it was anything any more than that, but that's what the latest versions of kind of building regs and BS 8300 are based upon. But just as a add-on to that is, have you heard of the document Design for the Mind, PAS 6463?
I think I have, because I've been reading it.
Yeah, so that was...
What is it, PAS?
PAS 6463.
Because when we did the HRP design, I was reading that there's a document that I think will end up in legislation.
Actually. It's going to be, yeah. That's what I was going to say, yeah. So this document was... created over 2 years ago by the British Standards Institute, and again, a bit like Project Rainbow, was a collaboration between various kind of industry experts, and as a result they created this document, which is design guidance for designing for neurodiversity, and it covers all aspects. It covers colour and materials and finishes and all sorts of other things. It's really, really, really good document.
Yeah, that is the one I was looking at.
Yeah.
Checking, because it's brilliant, isn't it?
It's really, really, really good. I mean, there are a couple of things in there from a colour perspective. I think some of the language used in there or the terminology is not quite what it could be, but that's probably just because I know what I know. But anyway, so BS 8300 is in the process of being updated, and it's highly likely that the information from this document now, PAS 6463, will go into the British Code of Practice, BS 8300. So that means that the current guidance on light reflectance values and that will probably stay the same, but there'll be an addition to it around colour and the types of colour used. So, yeah, that's a useful document for people to have to read hand in hand with the current kind of legislation and guidance, because it's undoubtedly going to be incorporated into the new version of that. So, yeah, it's a really good document.
Yeah, no, I when I was doing the research into the HRC, designing the the sage.
Yeah.
I was reading that. It was really fascinating. And I was like, oh, this has got to be like proposed legislation, the way it's been written.
Yeah. Yeah. My only thing I would say about it is around the kind of terminology around colour. So, for example, they say that more muted colours are better to use and to avoid neon. I think they use the word neon in there. And for me, I think that's a bit misleading because, well, first of two things to that. Not everybody knows what the word muted means, you know, or some of us do, obviously, but not everybody knows that. So I think this should be more clarification around what that means. But then the use of the words like neon, I'm sure they use the word neon. For me, neon is like neon lights, you know, really, and not many of us would use them in interiors anyway. So for me, it should have further information around like what we just discussed about
chroma and LRD, they should be being very specific about that, shouldn't they?
This is what I mean by muted, this is what I mean by neon, exactly. So I think that's my only little thing, so we'll kind of see what happens about that. But yeah, so it will be updated, which is only a good thing, isn't it? I think anything industry documentation and guidelines is a good thing. But as I think we touched on earlier, like, I'm not often surprised by the fact that a lot of designers don't necessarily know about these things. And I think, having gone on my own personal journey from domestic design into commercial design, I understand why lots of people don't know about it, because at one point I didn't know about it. But I think anything we can do to kind of raise awareness of the fact of, if you're designing commercial spaces, you really need to know about this stuff. And even if that's just you're designing a small boutique hotel with four bedrooms, you know, the same guidelines still apply. I think the more we can do to raise awareness to designers is good. I mean, I'm not sure there will ever be any kickback. You know, there isn't anybody from the government going around with a spectrophotometer checking if your LRVs are right. So
the building control officers are, though.
Yeah. Do they check LRVs? Do they?
Not all of them. But no. They do. Some of them.
Yeah. Okay.
Some of them, I assume they're checking it, or they assume, because we talk about it in our design packs, they just kind of go, yeah, that's fine. They don't actually check it, but they know that we've considered it.
But
building control officers, especially since last October 2022, have been a lot more stringent since the Building Safety Act changed and included principal designer role for the designer. So that's huge. But I was going to ask you, actually, so this podcast goes out to internationally, and about half of our listeners are in the US.
Yeah.
Is there any law? Do you know about any laws in the US?
No, I don't know. I don't know about the US. I think in other parts of the world, the regulations won't be as stringent as ours. So if you're working to UK guidelines, then you're kind of perhaps over and above what you should be. But I don't know about the US. I don't know what any of their legislation is.
But even if it isn't legislation, if you are designing for a commercial space, actually having it, considering this is so it actually makes a space, from an interior design perspective, it actually makes a space feel more finished. In my opinion. I went to France on holiday last year, and I was walking down these steps every day in this hotel, and they didn't have any stair nosing or any like lines. Ooh, just not my microphone. They didn't have any stair nosing or lines on the stairs. And I think because when you get used to it, you're used to just navigating quite easily.
Yeah.
And in the UK, that's what we can do, isn't it? Like, we can navigate in a commercial space really well. And when you go abroad and you kind of, I feel a little bit more lost.
Yeah. I think
in public spaces.
I'm exactly the same. So like I went to Mexico last year, not last year, the year before, and the hotel steps. So the lifts were always busy and we were only on the second floor. So we used to go down the steps. They were black marble steps. And of course, no differentiation between the nosing or anything at all. And so, you know, you'd go. Going up was obviously easier than coming down, but every time we came down, I would moan to my boyfriend about, oh, these flipping steps. Like, and I've got a decent visual acuity, you know, like, oh my gosh, these steps are terrible, you know. And he was like, you said that yesterday, because every day, yeah. Like you, I was just like, oh. But yeah, so but that's my one of
when
my
when you know.
Yeah.
You can't unknow it.
But I think in this country though, so for me, I kind of you kind of go, okay, that's you know, that was Mexico, like that's a different country. But I am surprised by the places I go to in this country that don't have that. So one of my pet peeves as well is like hotel bedroom design, and kind of how bad most of the ones I've been in are in terms of lighting. And so they may have, so that's just something to touch on. You can spend a long time getting the color and contrast right of the surface finishes in a space, but if the lighting is not the best it can be, that can completely destroy your scheme. So I think if you're a designer and you're designing a space, and I don't know, maybe working with a light, if you're working with a lighting designer, the lighting should be okay anyway. But yeah, but that is absolutely a consideration. So yeah, lighting for me in hotel bedrooms and hotel bathrooms is in most cases atrocious. But yeah, so I think in this country we still have that. And also I think we still in some spaces, so healthcare like NHS trusts, you know, some hospitals, for example, you go in and they've attempted to do colour and contrast, but the colours that have chosen are really, you know, like, so you'll go and I don't know that all the skirting and architrave will be bright blue to make sure that you can see it. And yeah, absolutely. It does what it's supposed
to do. That's a dementia colour, isn't it? The bright blue.
Well, yeah, I think about dementia, the guidance there is, and this comes from places like Stirling University, is to use brighter, more saturated colours. So that's where you'd probably look at the chroma as well as the LRV. So it doesn't say that there are any colours you should avoid for designing for dementia. The because of what happens to the lens of our eyes as we age, it makes things look more gray, so we tend to lose the blue and green aspect of the spectrum first. So it doesn't say to not use those colors, but just make them more chromatic, so make them a bit brighter. So yeah, I think blue does get used, I think probably because blue is the world's favorite color as well. But I think again, you can use the contrast and look at that and still make space look aesthetically pleasing for people, but still meet those. So yeah, so my pet thing is going around spaces, you know, restaurants, hotels or healthcare facilities and looking at it and going, that's not right. But yeah, maybe I should start doing that on social media, you know, like videos of all these places and critiquing them and going, what this is not so right. What you could do to improve it is X, Y, and Z. But yeah, like I say, lighting is one of my other things, like not a lighting designer at all, but just basic lighting in hotel rooms. Like I was in one earlier in the week and the colour and contrast was okay, but the lighting was atrocious. So when you first walked in the door, there was a light right in the ceiling, like a short pendant light hanging next to the door. And then the only other light was the two bedside lamps, but then some designer light that was one of those, like, you know, with like a rope hanging and again, a small pendant, but it was hanging right in the corner in front of a bit of the curtain, really. So it wasn't, and then over the other side of the room was where the desk was, so I wanted to sit and do a bit of work, but the light was all the way over there, you know, there was no light that side of the room at all, no desk light, no nothing. And even in the daytime, the in the morning, like I opened the curtains, but it still wasn't enough to make the space kind of lighting enough back kind of for me to work. And you just kind of go, oh God, when I walked in at the night time, it was dark because the only light, it was like over there in the corner. And then in the daytime, it wasn't even any better. But yeah, I think if I was to set up in private practice again, I'd probably hotel
Be the
design.
hotel inspector.
Yeah, honestly, I would just be like,
Toilet.
lighting in bathrooms as well. So I wear contact lenses. So again, one of my things in bathrooms is I need a decent light near the mirror so I can put my contact lenses in the morning. And again, the lights in hotel bathrooms are usually terrible as well. But
Doesn't take
anyway.
much, does it? It's like it's really simple. And I quite often, if I'm working in hospitality industry areas, I'll over-engineer the lighting because you need different light for different things. Like you say, you need a light at your desk, or you need, if you're working at your desk, or if you're going to bed, you need bedside lights, and you might want a corner light, but then you might want to flood the room. How do they clean? You need to flood the room with light to clean so you can clean effectively, you know, and just all of that is a
Yeah,
bit.
for me as well. In the morning, when you first wake up, like in a hotel room, I hate getting up. It doesn't matter where I am or what I'm doing, I'm terrible at getting up. So for me, I need as much light as possible in the morning. So exactly that. In a hotel room, I want to put light on and have it really bright so that it kind of makes me wake up. But there, it was like mood lighting again. And I was just like, I switched the lighting on in the morning. I was just like, oh my God, I could quite easily fall back to sleep because it's just nice ambient lighting. So I think that's when places like that have been designed en masse by somebody in, a studio somewhere. They don't get to go and perhaps maybe even people that don't use hotel rooms. For me, again, it goes back to that. Talk to the users, understand the users, even if you can't talk to them. How is somebody going to be working and walking through a space and using a space? What are they going to do? What are the touch points? What do they want at that point? For me, that's what good design is all about. It's not just about making it aesthetic and how good it looks like on a CGI or on a 3D render or a mood board. For me, it's got to be about what does it actually look like, but what does it function like? Because if it doesn't function well, it could be as beautiful as you like, but it's impractical.
Yeah, it's got to feel right for me. I it's all about that feeling of feeling safe and feeling looked after, and someone's being clear, you know, about wayfinding and sort of making sure that you know where you're going. Just simple things like putting a toilet sign, making sure that everywhere you sit in that restaurant or commercial space, you can see where the toilets are, or there's a sign somewhere that you can go, oh, okay, yeah, I know where the toilets are. Yeah, that's fine.
And I think, and then making it easy to follow as well, because the, but I think that's also exteriors as well. It's not interior. So I go to Exeter quite a lot, and the signs for the toilets all seem to point into the ether and not actually point you to the, so they've got all of the posts and all the signs saying toilets, but then it'll say go that way. So you walk down and then I mean, thankfully my boyfriend knows where they are, but if he, I get confused every time I go there and I'm like, but the, where are we going? Because the arrow said that way. And he's like, well, no, it's a little bit more that way. We're going that way. And you get to the next junction, whatever that is. And I'm like, well, he's not telling me now where I need to go. And he's like, oh no, I know where we go. We go that way. And I'm like, but the sign is not I need another sign there
I
that
need
explicitly
reassurance.
tells me, that I'm going to the right way. So I think, all of that. The absolutely navigation and wayfinding. And for me as well, colour, that's where colour comes in as a massive part of that. So
Yeah, no, me too.
Yeah, I would say thinking about LRVs for other surfaces. So obviously, as a paint manufacturer, we make sure you know what the LRV is of all of our colours. If you're designing commercial spaces, your any manufacturers and suppliers you use should tell you what the LRV is. Some flooring manufacturers will do it to the decimal point. So, at AXO, we say LRV 50. They might say 49.7 or whatever. For me, round it up, that's the obvious thing there. But if you have a surface that you don't know the LRV of, something that's already in a space, you can use something like the Dulux Visualizer app. So we have two Dulux apps. We have two visualizer apps. One is aimed at homeowners and the other one is aimed at specifiers. So it'll be the Dulux Trade Visualizer app. And in it is a colour picker tool. So you can do it live and from a photo, but what you can do is you can kind of put that over and you kind of have a little like crosshair that you can move around and it will tell you the nearest Dulux paint colour to it. So you can use something like that as a tool to kind of get the rough idea of an LRV of something else. So like I said, if you're designing a care home, the odds are the furniture's been in there a long time and you might not be replacing that. So you can use something like that to establish an approximate LRV so that you can then adjust your scheme around it. Yeah. Anyway, lovely to talk to you as well, as always.
We should definitely catch up at some point. All the lovely content.
All right. I shall speak to you soon. Take care.
Take care.
See you.
Bye.